I first began chasing down Ansberry long ago in 1979. At the time, I knew only headlines, with dozens of questions left unanswered. Was she French or Swiss? Was it conceivable she had only learned to fly in her mid-40s? What drove her to risk her life for a cause virtually of her own creation? Why had she never married? Was it true the desert nomads of northern Kenya know exactly the hour and by which thorn tree to gather to await the sound of her approaching plane? Whom did she answer to? Why did she conceal her past? Why had she really come to Africa? Friends resorted to generalities, painting Ansberry with the broadest of brushes. Skilled aviator, gifted doctor, and rousing character. As a freelance journalist, I was regularly on the lookout for heroes and originals, and Ansberry seemed to tick off all the right boxes. A bigger-than-life personality, exceedingly self-reliant, and driven to fulfill a remarkable African calling on her own terms. I began with a formal letter requesting an interview. No response. I wrote again, and again she did not answer. Finally, in February 1980, I called. The exchange was brief. Dr. Spurry said she had no time for journalists and nothing to contribute to an article. Her terseness put me off. Was this a show of modesty or bad temper? Did she really believe her life was of no interest? In March, I called again. This time, she answered straight away and sounded a different note. She was curious and faintly warm, and best of all, had 5 minutes to spare that afternoon. The date was March 10th, 1980. With thunderheads heaped above the Ngong Hills, I drove to her office, closeted in a pre-war bungalow beside Nairobi's Wilson Airport. She greeted me in mechanical monosyllables that cut through the high-octane rev of a country in love with aviation. Her firm handshake hinted that she had done her share of rotating props on bush strips and winching Land Rovers out of swollen rivers. As I settled into a straight-back chair and jimmied my notebook from my bush jacket, I followed her scalpel eyes and did my best to affect an air of calm. With Dr. Spurry, I hoped to discover a common core, a shared passion for Africa. Should we become friends one day, I would tell her my Africa tale, how, as a 16-year-old, I set sail along with three other schoolboys and a self-proclaimed explorer for Cape Town on the Winchester Castle, a refurbished Liberty ship. How, from the moment the ship's horn sounded in Southampton, the word Africa became a fixation, tantalizing me with freedom I lacked at home. My fellow passengers appeared to have stepped out of a Somerset Maugham short story. A freshly minted missionary was bound for an outpost in northern Rhodesia. A breakfast beer drinker, having failed as a prize fighter, was returning to Natal to take up sugar farming. One Lancashire family sought its fortune in the mines of southern Rhodesia. A saucy girl, disappointed by Britain, was returning to Picketburg to grow apples and to break up with her tiresome boyfriend. By the makeshift pool and in a dark panel saloon, I threw liar's dice, drank Pimm's cups, listened to tales of the felt, and tapped my foot in time to songs of the Great Trek. I had staked everything that in Africa I, all of 16, would find my way. Braced for transformation, I spent the last night of the 2-week passage lying on hemp ropes in the bow. When dawn mists cleared, Cape Town's perimeter landmark, Table Mountain, all lavender, towered to port. Soon, Malay stevedores jousted us to the dock. The gangplank was barely in place when I took my first African footstep. Straight away, I crossed a threshold into the epic. It only got better. In Southwest Africa, we climbed into a cave with a 2,000-year-old petroglyph of a warrior. In the Kalahari, bushmen fled from our Land Rover, and at night, herds of elephants ghosted past our cots under the stars. When I fished the Zambezi, crocodile eyes cut the river's surface and ghosted toward my knobby knees. Stunned and seduced by Africa's ferocity, generosity, and primal heart, I barely slept for 2 months. Now, in Anshbury's office, after 20 years of knocking about the continent, I was ready to acknowledge a kindred spirit. Surely she too must be a victim of le mal d'Afrique, the Africa passion. As she organized the clutter on her desk, my eyes ranged around the room. On a shelf lay a model of a dhow, the wooden ships that traded along the East African coast for well over 2,000 years. To the right were Makande carvings of stylized, emaciated women propped against thick medical tomes. She had not yet bothered to frame a munificent commendation honoring her 10 years of service to the Foundation, signed by His Excellency Honorable Daniel Arap Moi, the President of the Republic of Kenya and Commander-in-Chief of the Kenya Armed Forces. Notebooks were stacked willy-nilly on her desk, and at her feet lay two kikapus, sizal baskets bursting with the bouquet of fresh fruits and vegetables. The moment I began my pitch, Dr. Spurry interrupted. "Okay, meet me tomorrow morning at 8, sharp, otherwise I leave."